Hello, and aye, we're back. Welcome to Scots Language Radio. I'm Frieda Morrison, and this is the programme that likes to celebrate having to deal with the Scots language, even the wither. Well, and maybe when I ging that far. But in this edition, we'll tuck you out of yourselves to forget the wheat that's been and make you concentrate on other things, strange and one-offy things. Like, for instance, can you guess what makes this noise? Now, fit marks that quacking noise and fit marks that piping noise. Tell you later. And when you're thinking about that, think about writing in Scots. Fan do ye deet and fan do ye nae deet? Is there a richt time? And we're speaking to the Scotland's Macker and National Poet of Scotland, Liz Lockhead, about that very subject. And hearing fae een of my favourite writers and storytellers, Jess Smith, about her life in the pages and other places. And we're among the bee swarms on Deeside. Swarms of bees are we, with beekeeper Ian Smith. But we begin with a question, een that nae only writers come face to face with, but in this case, a consultor National Poet of Scotland, or National Macker, poet and playwright Liz Lockhead, for I met up with at the Solus Festival outside Perth. The question then, fan is it recht for a writer's point of view to write in Scots?
People can write in Scots whenever they want to write in Scots. My personal thing about writing in Scots is I use it a lot in drama. I write a lot of characters who speak in Scots and so on. I don't write critical essays in Scots or so on because my natural voice for that is English with a Scottish accent.
What was the first thing you ever wrote in Scots?
The first major bit of writing I did in Scots was Tartuffe in 1986, I think. I was working on a translation of Molière's Tartuffe for the Royal Lyceum Theatre Company, and I didn't see why. I'd had arguments with them about Scots and Scots accent, mostly. I'd said, for instance, there had been a Molière play the season before, and it was The Miser, and they had the miser. Tam Dean Byrne played the miser, the dad, in a Scottish accent, and the rest of the translation was a translation into standard English, but he did that with a Scottish accent. And I was saying that I found that, you know, that the family's daughters spoke RP and everything. So I was sort of arguing with that, and so they said to me, we're doing a version of Tartuffe next season, do you want to translate it? And I said yes, and they said, is it going to be in Scots? And I said, absolutely not, no, it'll be in English for the actors to do in their own accents. But when I started writing it, it just started to come out very strongly in the voice of my grandmother.
Do you need to hear voices?
Why? Yeah, it's voices.
Is that what it is?
It's voices for me, yes. It's voices. So if I was writing a critical essay, the voice would not be a Scottish voice that I was writing down. You know, it would have a Scottish accent, because I've got a Scottish accent as I'm talking to you just now. I've got a Glasgow accent. A lot of people call that not Scots. They think of it as Keely talk or whatever. But my normal mode of speaking is something like this. It's really standard English with a Glasgow accent.
But fit about advice.
My voice. But you can write in any way you want, but that's for different purposes. You see, writing, you're always a voice.
There must be pitfalls, though, Liz, about writing in Scots. If you can imagine the ambitions that some folk have. Okay, I'm going to write in Scots, and then they turn out something that doesn't sound right.
They're going about it the wrong way. They're not coming from the voice. They're not coming from the voice. They're coming from a conscious decision to write in Scots because it's a good idea, or it's politically this or that. I'll tell you. I'll give you a poem, a bilingual poem, called. This sums up quite a lot. Now, this was written after a phone call from BBC London asking me to encourage children all over Britain to keep writing in hometown English. And she said she wanted a dialect poem from me, and I said I didn't like the word dialect because it insinuated that some people speak properly and some people don't. She took my point, but she said, did I want to do it anyway? So I said, yes, I did. And so I said to her, where do these kids come from? John O'Groats to Land's End. And I knew that I could not even write a Scottish, for a Glasgow set of school kids, something that they would all understand. So I decided to write a thing bilingually so that it would have a translation built into it. So it goes like this. Kids' poem, Bairn sang. It was January, and a guide reach day the first day I went to the school. So my mum happed me up in my good navy blue nap coat with a red tartan hood, birled a scarf around my neck, put on my pixie in my pockies, it was that bitter, said, now you'll no starve, gave me a wee kiss and a kid on scalp in the bum and sent me off across the playground to the place I'd learned to say. It was January and a really dismal day the first day I went to school. So my mother wrapped me up in my best navy blue topcoat with the red tartan hood, twirled a scarf around my neck, pulled on my bubble hat and mittens, it was so bitterly cold, said, now you won't freeze to death, gave me a little kiss and a pretend slap in the bottom and sent me off across the playground to the place I'd learn to forget to say it was January and a guide-reich day, the first day I went to the school. So my mum happed me up in my good navy blue nap coat with the red tartan hood, barreled a scarf around my neck, put on my pixie and my pockies. It was that bitter. Oh, saying it was one thing, but when it came to writing it, in black and white, the way it had to be said was as if I was posh, grown up, male, English and dead. Now, I remember the method I used to write that poem, which was to first of all just write down a list of all the Scots words, which I don't normally think of as Scots words, but just the words that I normally use. I thought consciously about how Scots they were, like barreled and pixie and pockies and red tartan rather than, you know, and I just thought of all these things, but I hadn't the story, I just had a mass of words that I used. Dreich. I actually wrote down all the words that I could think of when I thought about it, that consciously, that were Scots words.
Simple question. Do you think that Scots should be taught in schools?
I do think Scots should be taught in schools, but not as a separate thing. I think language should be taught in schools. Voice should be taught in schools. There's a boy over there, a lovely boy you should talk to, Declan Walsh. I mean, he sings in a Scottish accent and he sings some Scots words, but that's because it's his voice. I believe in voice and the word and the writing and the language, and I don't think it needs to be translated into an antique form of it. Edwin Morgan, who was the first Macca, the real Macca, you know, he disliked the term the Macca because it was antique. I know what it means. It just means a maker. I don't mind very much. I don't mind telling somebody that means a maker, and that's fine. But I've always got to say I'm the Macca or the National Poet of Scotland. You know, it is a self-conscious use of the word. I don't mind that. But, you know, I think we should not have to apologise for it in the way that it seems to me we're doing if we're translating falsely into some idea of Scots, which would exclude other modern things that are maybe more urban or Irish or American or whatever. I just believe in language.
And communication.
And communication, yes.
Great, Liz. Our Macca and national poet, Liz Lockhead, at the Solus Festival. A lot of festivals going on just now, and special events, of course, our summer. And if you had been, for I had been, I was at the Killiecrankie battlefield a few days ago, delighted to be at a special day commemorating the battle on the 27th of July, 1689, the first Jacobite battle in Scotland. And watching Fitzcarrd, the soldiers of Killiecrankie, the Williamites and the Jacobites, gone through the reenactment of the battle. Williamites, of course, led by General Mackay, and the Jacobites by Bonnie Dundee, or Claverhouse, as he was called. This is the Corries singing that song, Killiecrankie.
For he been sae brawled, for he been sae branky, for he been se brolad, come ye by Kelly Cranky. And ye had been what I hae been, ye wad na been sae canty, oh. And ye had seen what I hae seen, on the braes o' Killiecrankie, oh. I fought at land, I fought at sea, at hame I fought my auntie, oh. But I met the devil and Dundee on the braes o' Killiecrankie, oh. And ye had been what I hae been, ye wad na been sae canty, oh. And ye had seen what I hae seen on the braes o' Killiecrankie, oh. The bold Pitcairn fell way afar, and clamors got a clanky, oh. And I had fed a wrath o' glad on the braes o' Killiecrankie, oh. And ye had been what I hae been, ye wad na been sae canty, oh. And ye had seen what I hae seen on the braes o' Killiecrankie, oh. Oh, fie Mackay, what gart ye lie in the bush o' yon the branky, oh. Ye'd better kiss King Willie's loaf and come by Killiecrankie, oh. There's nae shame to swing ye, oh. There's sour sleighs on other braes, and the deals at Killiecrankie, oh. And ye had been what I hae been, ye wad na been sae canty, oh. And ye had seen what I hae seen on the braes o' Killiecrankie, oh.
The Corries were Killiecrankie. And let me introduce my studio companion at the stage. It is Steve Byrne who joins me now. Steve, Killiecrankie, what a history in that song, isn't it?
Aye, there's an awful lot. It's you know, the songs that appeared in Hogg's Jacobite Relics, and there's been versions by Burns and all sorts, and interesting language in there. There's things that I've sung the song since I was a bairn, and I've never kent exactly what it meant. And you know, a great Scots word that's in there is a gled. Er I had fed an Athol gled. Do you ken what a gled is?
I thought it was a glade.
A gled is a red kite.
He fed on a red kite?
Aye. Er I had fed an Athol gled, before I'd fed a red kite to the Athol.
So. Wow, and the sewer sleighs.
Sewer sleighs and Athol's braes. That's sewer berries. It's the slough in English, or the blackthorn. So
it was a really special day. Just right for the start, I was going through the ticket place where you get the tickets to go into the battlefield bit, and this Lancaster bomber flew over here, and I was saying, is that part of it? And they said, no, they just practice here, going up and doing Killiecrankie. And it was just a fascinating day finding out the bits of history, especially. I was trying to get to the bottom of the story about Fit happened to Claverhouse's armour. You can't think.
I didn't. You'd mentioned it before, didn't
I? Well, Finney was lying indeed, because he was shot in the side, you see. And then he was shot, we think, put him out of his misery between the een. So he was lying indeed. And some dear enough, with his uniform.
I think so.
It was a bonny uniform, specially made for him, I think. And so his relatives had they suspected the Cameron clan. I'm sorry to announce this, but they do. There's evidence to letters, nothing. Mm. And Claverhouse's relatives had to write to the Cameron saying, "Can we get his clays back, please? Can we get his armours back?" Didn't you get that?
No.
Right, he was lying there. He was shot, but the bit that I couldn't get over was the fact that they shot him between the een as well to put him out of his misery.
Oh, jings.
According to the stories now, but there's so many stories there.
Aye.
Right, for Arwen. The honour of laying the commemorative wreath that day went to writer and storyteller Jess Smith. Now, I met up with Jess earlier at the Solas Festival and, of course, at the Killiecrankie Day. Jess describes herself as a Scottish traveller for writes books. I would just describe her as one of my favourite folk. And this little blether with Jess was Dean out the back of the marquee at the Solas Festival. And Jess told me how she started writing books.
My father wrote a book. It never went anywhere. And I loved writing. And I always liked writing as well, but I never ever really thought I'd be a writer. But when my father in 1982 was leaving us, it was last breaths, and I kind of made a silent promise that one day I would go on with it and that. But I didn't really have any knowledge because I'd been loved and cared for and the education system had changed a lot by the time I come along. And there was a lot more freedom after the war, you know, whereas my father's day before the war, travellers were hounded and hunted and that, and you had to get in a house and you had to have, you know, as they called it, respectability, which wasn't afforded the travelling folk. So I was like, wait, my father had eight, mum and daddy had eight bairns, and I was the one in right in the middle, maybe positioned there because I was going to be doing what I was going to do, not even caring. But I made that promise to him, but I was full of pain and emotion, and, you know, you say things when you're about to lose the person that means so much to you in your life. And I had a family, and after I lost them, I kept that promise, but right away at the back of my mind, I never thought for one minute I would ever write a book. And it wasn't until I was coming off Bucolette of Moher and Glencoe and I never heard the piper that I went home and I thought, right, I'm going to write this book. But I wrote my book, you know, my story of living in a bus, going to Berries and all the characters within it and the songs and the stories and the poems that I had been raised with and the riddles and all that. And I just took off. I got a lot of encouragement from a local writers group. And they helped me write, okay. And that's how it started.
Could I go back a wee bit further? Just tell me about that day that you tell folk about in here, about the bus arriving home.
Oh, yes.
Your mum, what do you know?
Well, Mammy had just had baby number eight, an eighth daughter. My father was scunnered to death, he was out wanting a son. But anyway, it was never to be. But she was scrubbing her washing, built a bath of water, a metal bath on the outside fire. She had a scrubbing board, the carbolic soap, and sweat was pouring off her in buckets. And she was battering this soap onto the scrubbing board. And anyone
she
went
was
near
in
the
hippins, wasn't she?
Hippins, aye. Yeah. She was scrubbing the hippins because in those days, that's how you washed things with this big bar of carbolic soap and a good rub on the scrubbing board. So she was right in the middle of it when this bus appeared and it came out of the tunnel and into the campsite and out jumps my father. You know, I'm saying, oh, Mammy, look, there's the bus is coming in. She's like, it's some idiot doesn't care where they're going. She says, the driver will turn round about, you know, when he hits the dead end and go back. And I says, no, Mammy, no. And the bus brake was pulled on and I never forget every minute of that and instant of that. As a five-year-old, it was vivid in my mind. My daddy jumped out the bus, shoved the Kilmarnock bonnet to the back of his head and come over and lifted my mammy up with the elbows and turned her around about and he says, look, Jeannie, I've brought you a mansion. Dripping in the soap suds and the sweat, she looked at him and she just hardly glanced at the bus. It was a Bedford, you know, a lovely big fancy bus. And she says, well, you can put it back where you got it, but I'm not biding in that.
Which she did.
Which she had no say, really, because the man's the man and the provider. And at the end of the day, he gutted it out. I mean, as mobile homes go, that was 1953. That was a classic, classic bus. And there was a Queenie stove bolted into it, a sideboard for all my mammy's dishes and pots and pans. The luggage racks, you know, we were all getting a bit each for put all our clothes in. We never had a lot of clothes. Travellers didn't have a lot of clothes. But what we had was we washed, did our own washing and put it all up in our own wee bits.
So how long did you bide in the bus?
10 years. I was 15 and I was roaring and greeting when my father says this bus is to be scrapped, it's done. And I'll never forget going back to visit, you know, when I was working my sister was living in Glen Rothes and I was working in a paper mill. And I went back to see it and it was the doo, you know, the clucky doo that came flying out the door and nearly knocked my head off. And I went, oh, pigeons in where my old mum and daddy used to bide. I was broken hearted.
Was that the inspiration for your first book?
The bus, it was the knowledge of it, you know, and I think that it had actually penetrated my heart and it had meant so much to me. You know, every bully I tilt the bus, you know, my wee bed, my daddy had made out the seats and I would lie and speak into the fabric of this bus, you know, and I would tell the bus.
That was Jessie's journey, wasn't it?
Jessie's journey, and I just felt I had to do it, you know, and it was, it just seemed the right thing today, you know, a Scottish lassie writing about her living in her land and what it offered us. You know, the travellers have a great respect for the land. you know, forget what the media say. If we didn't look after the land didn't look after us. And when we dug a pit to put a fire in, that turf had to go back.
Yeah, you know? What the fuck did that now, did it?
No, nowadays. But life's changed for everybody nowadays. You know, I mind when bank managers were like your doctors, you could tell them anything and trust them. Now look what's happening. It just was those days, you know. I was happy to have lived in them.
Can I take you back to yesterday? It's not a long way to go back. We're going back and forth in time again. But something momentous happened to you yesterday, didn't it?
Oh, golly, Frieda. I started a campaign a way back to get a wee area and on the opposite the Hells Glen Road, you know, between Dunoon and Shachar. And there was a heart there. Now, the locals said it was stones that had been placed there by families whose loved ones never came back from the Battle of Culloden. I thought that was actually quite far out, and I didn't really believe it. But then other folk were saying, it's a Celtic cross. You know, when they started to take the religion out of Scotland, they broke all the Celtic crosses, you know, the after the Reformation. And it goes back 500 years, and then someone says, no, it's a Zion, you know, Auld Lang Syne, the Gallon place. It's the Druids used to stand in the Zions, and when you see it, it sits looking over on this hillside, looking over Loch Fyne, and you would imagine a torch getting lit there, and the calling, you know, to the clans to come. There was news, either a birth or a death or something like that.
So what did you call it there, a special site?
A Zion.
S-Y-N-E
or S-I-O-N or Z-I-O-N. I know that sounds Hebrewish, but then there's a lot of that ancient Hebrewness in Scotland. You know, you've got the Hebridean Isles, you've got Jura and many words and anything prefixed with Aber. You know, you've got to look at that. It's a history that's been denied us and we've never really had a chance to make any decisions about it.
Back to the Dicker's Heart again.
Well, I started this petition to get this place scheduled. I only want it looked after to begin with because there was cattle trampling over it and it wasn't very visible, and so I got in touch with the locals and the people who owned the land and that, and I wasn't getting anywhere, so I got Mike Russell. You know, he's a wonderful man. He says it as it is.
MP.
Aye, and he come on board. He said, I'll do this.
MSP, if you say.
MSP, yeah, and he got right on board, took photographs of it, and he started to tell the other MPs about it, and so we started a petition up in Parliament in 2014, and we got over 1,000 signatures. And by now, the locals had, or the landowner had, put up a cage to protect it, and we had went in and we did it and cleaned it up and made it visible. So we were really looking now, because I'm saying we, because others had come on board to help me. Wonderful folks. And then we approached Historic Scotland, who kept saying, no, we're not going to schedule it, doesn't meet the criteria.
So were you beginning to lose heart about this?
I saw myself doing this, still two sticks. I says, I'll go to my grave doing this, trying to get this recognised, because Scotland's travellers don't have a place to call their own. So I asked Historic Scotland, and they said, categorically, if that's the right word, it does not meet our criteria. So I asked the petition board to invite Historic Scotland, and they went and sat there, and the petition board says, perhaps your criteria is wrong.
Oh.
And that's the first time ever.
Oh.
You should maybe include the Scottish travellers in your criteria and go away and look at it. And they did, you know, they courageously, and I use that word, you know, a great broad spread of things relating to how authority has talked and treated travellers on sort of in the back burner sort of thing. They went away, and this guy, Dr. Findlater, worked hard with us, the School of Scottish Doctors. Everybody was involved in giving them, educating them in the culture of a travelling people. And on Friday afternoon, well, actually at 1 o'clock on Friday, the petition board got in touch and says, Jess, we're looking at the end of the summer recess before we hear anything. And I said, why? Because Historic Scotland haven't got in touch. Well, at 4:30, Historic Scotland phoned me up and says, have you seen your email we just sent you? And I says, no, I'll go and switch it on. So I looked at it and says, like, go down to such and such, and it actually calls the Tinker's Heart a national monument, and they are going to schedule it. so.
That means it's protected.
That's protected, that's recognised, and it's the first time ever, ever, anywhere. You know, you've got the Native Americans that have fought for protection of their areas. They've fought hard for that, took them a long, long time. You've got the Aborigines, you know, getting their white sands protected and all sorts. And the travelling people have got this wee heart where their folks used to get married, the bairns used to get christened, and the dead were blessed at the top of Loch Fyne. And we now have it protected by our very own government. Isn't that wonderful?
I need not ask you just what this all means, because you came for the Danes. Abdi came for the Danes. But a recognition for your culture,
it's the recognition, Frieda. It's actually an acceptance of the culture by, not, you know, by our authorities. Now, the very high, you know, people that make the rules in the land we live in have said, yes, let's protect this. It belongs to the Scottish travellers. Scottish travellers have really meant nothing to anyone but ourselves. You know, we respect ourselves and our ancestors, but now the other side are saying it. The authorities that have, you know, that have bombed us, everything all through history, have actually come on board.
One of the happiest memories of my broadcasting life is when we were speaking about earlier, me rumbling about being rumbled from backwards and forwards in the back of a car when you and Sheila Stewart were driving through Blairgowrie, and we were on our way to the Berryfields because we were making a programme about the cant.
That's remember right,
what
yeah.
A great day that was, wasn't it?
On the River Erick yonder. I never laughed so much in all my life.
We were, yeah. The whole programme was laughing. It's my abiding memory of Sheila, of course, who left us just before Christmas.
Yeah.
But you can, could you say something, Jess, just to finish off this, in the cant, that just fit, would sum up what you feel?
The Barrius Mort in my life, you know, and we've kent each other since we're kinchin, her a wee bit older than myself, is that manishe, Sheila Stewart. And as long, you know, as the sang is sung and the tale is telt, manged, as the tale is manged, mm-hmm. our cant lives on. For that's what she left behind.
Because she was going to do the official opening.
She was going to do the official opening of the heart. And she says to me, and I said to her last year, I says, that's the petition. I says, we'll work hard at this. And she says, I've been working hard all my days, Jess. She says, to get the travellers recognised. I worked in Sheffield. I sang to the Pope. You know, she says, mm-hmm. I've been in America. I've sang to the... And she says, and that's me singing my culture. But the entire culture needs to be recognised by the country. The bairn in the womb and the Eolian heading for the grave has got to be included. Not just people like me that have been privileged to sing to folk because I've been gifted with a voice, she says, but everybody, so that the young can stand up and say, yes, that's who I am.
Jess Smith, writer and storyteller. And Jess has written 6 books. Jess's Journey was the first Dean. Last Dean was the Why of the Wanderers. And they're not difficult to find, and it's a treasure trove. And Jess, Steve, as you know, is a treasure herself.
A champion of the traveller's culture. I mean, that was just quite emotional listening to that, to
it
be honest.
Was.
Just national monument. I mean, that's 12 words that I think... If you think about the travellers and their culture, that in itself, in terms of the songs and the stories and their way of life that's been hidden, although a bushel for hour long, that in itself is a national monument, and that they've got a tangible place now to kind of associate that. I love that part about you kind of, if it doesn't fit the rules, then maybe the rules are wrong. I mean, that's kind of the way through history. You can, I mean, not to kind of overblow things a bit, but it's right back there with the civil rights and all that kind of thing that... You know, it's just about time that we normalise these kind of things.
I remember doing a film about that they were saying about there's too many farmers. Economists were saying there was too many farmers in Scotland. And that somebody said, well, maybe there's just too many economists. Assuming the same way. But time for mere music. Faye Gary West, appropriately. Gary's Faye, that part of Perthshire we were speaking about mm-hmm. earlier, near mm-hmm. Killiecrankie, or near a boot, anyway. This is Faye's album, The Isle of Ball, and this is The Mason's Apron. Barry West with the Mason's Apron, that's for his album, The Isla Ball. And I was just saying to Steve, it's just great listening to Jess earlier, fantastic news about the Traveller's Heart, and good to hear Jess sound and say it on form. Right, now, Steve, we've both been talking in festivals over the last few weeks. Me, the Solus Festival, as I mentioned, Potsoi Boat Festival, Lossie, you just mentioned that Killy Cranky weekend. And you've just been to Killarley and other places. Right. There's a lot going on, and we're just into the Edinburgh Festival. What's going on there?
Indeed. Aye. Well, it's the biggest of them aren't at the Edinburgh Festival. Folk that is into Scottish culture might be interested in going along to the Acoustic Music Centre at St Bride's. Organised by Stonyport Associates and other folk. A whole bunch of acts on 11th August, Myra Green and Anna Massey. We've played them in the programme once or twice.
They're coming up in a minty.
Very good. Mike Vass is doing In the Wake of Neil Gunn, which is a brilliant project, music today with Neil Gunn's writing, the 20th to 22nd. Archie Fisher, Dick Gochan and Patsy Reid, all sorts of folk singing there. That's the St Bride Centre in Orwell Terrace. It's Fringe Venue 123. There's Robin Stapleton, who I've played in the show a couple of times, and Claire Hastings, the great pals from Dumfries and Galloway, and they're doing a new musical telling the life story of Robert Burns, Cad A Man's A Man, and that's taking place from the 3rd to the 8th of August, and it's out at a place called Clifton Hall, which is Fringe Venue 378, and so they'll be singing, and I think Nancy McElhose, and they're playing in the character. The characters aye. Are the various folk in Burns'
life. There's great photos going about of them, both in costume, aye.
Aye, and are the tresses and a thing going on. So. And Folk at the Oak, the Royal Oak is a Weel Kent drinking establishment in Edinburgh, a late night session venue, and they have a concert every night for the 1st of August through to the 30th.
Wow.
Paddy Bott for the Wee Folk Club gets involved and has all sorts of folk in. Jim Malcolm's playing there, and Carlin Alan Pryor, who are a great couple of singers. If you haven't come across them, Alan Pryor had me in bits singing at Killarley. He was just absolutely, he's a brilliant, brilliant voice.
Okay, before we speak about Killarley now, there's a new play going to be doing around called Spectre Tune.
That's right, it's just, it's premiering at Cumbernauld Theatre. It's a partnership between a theatre company called Storm Oak, which just means the young storm in Gaelic, and Cumbernauld Theatre. And they're doing a play which is called Spectre Town. And it doesn't really give away what it's about, but the synopsis here, it's inspired by the bothy ballads for Scotland's northeast. The playwright is Elspeth Turner, and directed by Matthew Lenton. And it says here it's exploring the boundaries between the past and the present and the future with Doric and song and tradition and all sorts of things. And interestingly, horses.
Horses?
Horses. And folk maybe doesn't ken, but there's a tradition, a bit of a hidden tradition in the northeast of Scotland called the Horseman's Word. Mm-hmm. And they've got into the archives and researched that. And there's a bra book that you can get ahead of from Timothy Neat. He's in a quintet of books about kind of country life in Scotland. And the Horseman's Word is a brilliant
it's
volume
a cracker,
of that.
I've read it. Yeah. Absolutely and, love it.
And that's kind of an initiation ceremony for apprentice horsemen and... You can, is the brother a blind man, and all these kind of scripts.
And they had a consultant for the play as well, didn't they?
They did, and then I kind of he'd calm sell that, but my good pal, your good pal, Scott Gardner, was in there singing songs.
Consultant?
And, aye. He tells me, I don't know kind of he was just trying not to get in trouble with his bothy pals, but he tells me he didn't tell them anything about the Horseman's Word, because it was a secret society. It was a bit kind of like the Masons in its day. So
Spectre Town is at the festival?
Aye, that's playing at the Assembly Hall in New College, which is in the Mound, for the 6th to the 31st of August.
And then it's careering about the countryside.
Oh, it's kind of about out of the place. I mean, it's from Greenock to Stirling, Bathgate. There's a residency in Aberdeen, Creef, St Andrews, Inverness, and then they have a wee kind of small hall tour about Bankery and the Broch, Fraserburgh, Ellen, and the British Legion in Bucky, which tickled us as well.
I'm trying to catch up with Elspeth Turner, the writer, and she, obviously she's enough a busy wifey, so we're hoping to hear Elspeth with us in the next programme, but we're best wishes to her and the cast. Now, yous was at Killarley singing weekend up in Aberdeenshire, surviving sleeping in a tent out in a park.
Only just.
You suffer for your art. But tell us a bit about the Killarley singing weekend.
Well, Killarley Farm Park is at Echt, just outside Aberdeen, kind of West Hill kind of area. Mm-hmm. And Tam and Anne Reid, long-time supporters of traditional singing, and Tam and his family had been at the Killarley Farm Park since about 1935, and they turned it into a kind of museum, but still be a working element, so folk could go along and see that. and how things used to be with a horse and all that. But Tam passed away in 2003. And they decided they would keep this singing festival going in his memory. And sadly, his wife Anne passed on in 2006. But since then, a whole bunch of folk have got together with their family, the Walker family at Killarley, and folk for the Elphinstone, the University of Aberdeen, and folk like Scott Gardner mm-hmm. and all sorts getting together. And they get about 10 singers for all over Scotland, England,
weekend.
And Ireland.
Aye. Apart for the weather.
Apart from the weather's a bit hit and miss.
I saw the photograph of you in your tent and I thought, they're suffering for their art. You know. But you can, it's a good weekend, and you mentioned Tam Reid there, and your chosen track for this episode is a song, Fae Tam, Inouye's signature tunes.
Aye.
This is the Bonnie Wee Tramping Lass, Fae Tam Reid.
As I get out the summer's night, I hae a wee bit stroll. Ne'er thinking o' the years gone by, oh, I wander by the toll. I hinna again far by the toll when Corby's burn I passed. And what do you think that I met there but a bonny wee trampin' lass? Oh, far ye gone, oh, give me your hand, for ye dean, says I. Had up your head, my bonny wee lass, and dinna look so shy. Far do you bide, far do you stay, come tell to me your name. Do you think your father'd be angry now if I were to see ye him? Tree rum dee dee da la 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 dee. She said that she was working down in the melting fields, tramping bunks or yarning and like the donkey wheel. She said she had in Bob a week and was nae on for time. Says, oh, my lass, what matters that when you will soon be mine? Oh, far ye gone, give me your hand, oh, for ye dean, says I. Had up your head, my bonny wee lass, and dinna look so shy. Far ye bide, far do ye stay, come tell to me your name. Do you think your father'd be angry now if I were to see ye him? La 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 dee. Oh, now that we are married, oh, we're as happy as can be. Twa little lasses by your side, a laddie on our knee. I often stroll down by the toll when I think the days gone past. But as long's I live, I'll ne'er forget my bonny wee trampin' lass. Oh, far ye gone, give me your hand, for ye dean, says I. Hide up your head, my bonny wee lass, and dinna look so shy. Far ye bide, far ye stay, come tell to me your name. Do you think your father'd be angry now if I were to see ye here?
Tam Reid singing Bonnie Wee Trampin' Lass was fantastic. Heard Tam singing that in Money on Occasion. I was telling Steve there the first time I used to get into a wee pub outside the Killarley Inn or the Killarley Pub, and there was Tam singing some of the best songs with a fiddle player called Leslie and an accordionist, and there was tartan wallpaper and just the cross swords, and it was just one of the best sessions you could ever imagine.
Some singer.
Other signature, of course, is about the Twa Clydesdales, the Prince Ian Jean. We maybe sing that in, maybe play that in another episode. No, there's been enough of swarming going on over the northeast, nae only at Killarley. But it's nae just the council road man as well this time, although they are prone, there's other things prone up there. But this time it's bees, and I've got six hives on my croft out the back of the shed, looked after by the Tarland Bee Group. I'm nae the beekeeper, I'll just make that absolutely clear. And for that time, they've hid, trying to catch up with their bees, swarming our place, up trees, up hooses, up lambs. They just escape and ging off. Aye, near the Tarland Bee Group, like it's the bees. Fit's gone on, I said, fit's gone on. Well, we heard for Ian Smith for a bine on an earlier episode, Dowsing for Water. Ian is fit, I would call, a master beekeeper. So he's the manny to tell me about swarms. So sitting out in his garden, surrounded by his beehives, Ian told me first about how he got started among bees.
I started when I was a young loon. My grandfather was, and my great-grandfather was a great lad for bees. I just got interested and it just all developed from there.
How many hives have you got now?
I've hanna counted because this is the swarming season, but I would hear with 80, I would think.
No, that's one of the things I was going to speak to you about, the swarming season.
Swarming season, aye.
I've had the bee groups up catching swarms for weeks now. What's the swarming season?
The swarming season, well, in this area, it seems to change in areas. The lower level you're at, that starts swarming earlier. Like even the south of England, their swarming's finished a while ago. Right, they May, June. Mm-hmm. But in this area up the east side, it's June, July, and I've even seen it into August.
So do the bees just tuck off for the hive, just decide out for a while?
Well, it's to do with the bees in the hive, the queens, and also the weather, actually. It's the nice weather, especially blinky sunny weather. That's when you'll get swarms.
Blinky days.
Aye, blinky days.
Aye. So they just decide, right, it's a bonny blinky day. the queen thinks, well, right, boys, we're off, come on.
There's a wee bit of mare in that, and the old queen, it's always her that swarms first. And she's made preparations along with the bees a wee while before that, and things start to change, and when the weather suits, then they'll come off.
What kind of preparations?
Preparations will be actually, there'll be queen cells in there, which is going to hatch just after a swarm. So they've made all that preparation so that when the old queen comes out and goes away to make her hen house, if you like, she has left young queens to carry on her.
Inside the same hive.
Inside the same hive.
No. Find the bees swarm. They can swarm anyway. I mean, you can get a great big, it's like a bar hanging for trees, and you can get bars hanging for hooses and posts.
That's right. They come out in various sizes, because the top swarm, what's the first swarm, is always the biggest one for that particular hive. Mm. They come out in the land somewhere. There's no, the land in a fence, the land in a bush.
I've seen folk
whatever.
Climbing trees even.
Aye.
I've got photographs of folk climbing trees.
Have you?
Aye. But it's expensive. I mean, a hive or a swarm is an expensive thing to lose, isn't it?
Oh, aye, to lose, aye. If you was buying it as a nuclei, which is actually just a small stock of bees. Mm-hmm. At the moment, you're speaking about a couple of £100.
Aye. And they just flee off.
Aye, they just go off. Just
a
the cat.
As I said, red well, boys were away.
What actually happens is they come out and they form somewhere local. Very local to where they are, whether it be a bush or whatever. And they'll bide there for a set time. It might be an hour, it might be 2 days. But when they're there, they put out scout bees and they find where their next home is going to be. Oh. It could be somebody else's hive, it could be doing somebody else's lum, it could be, on a way, it seems to them to be secure in some way they can winter and produce again. They put out scouts to check it out, the size of it and nothing.
Now, once they've got their house, then they start making honey.
Yes, they start building comb. And that comb, they put in all queen's case, but eggs in, which will produce young bees, new bees, and also it will take in food for the winter to come in the form of honey, nectar.
So they're taking in pollen all the time?
They're taking in pollen to feed the young bees, yes.
Mm-hmm. So how do they make the honey?
Oh, I don't know.
No?
I don't know how they do it.
But they take in the pollen?
They take it in and they eventually finishes off as honey.
And they make the comb themselves, the wax?
Yes, yeah. Aye, they build it by themselves.
It's a miracle in a way, isn't it?
And every cell in a honeycomb is exactly the same size, new built. Every one.
Can I look, see, from we're sitting in front of you, a few of your hives here, there's that hive up here on the left that's got a heise of bees running about the opening. Why is that?
Well, that particular one, that's a swarm. It went in there about a week ago.
Did you capture it?
I got it off the bush just opposite you here.
All right.
But it's a fairly strong one, that's why there's a bit of activity there. Mm. Plus the fact that this is really the first sun they've got since they were since I put them in.
It has been wheat ever since.
So they're coming out and they're stirring up and taking their distance and things like that.
Now, how do you get them to bide, though? I mean, you put them in there, you capture them in your skep.
Yes,
you? See, I'm getting good at my terms now, your skep.
Aye.
You capture them in the skep.
No, a local name's a Rusky.
A Rusky, is it?
That's a local name,
okay.
Aye.
Because it's made of straw and it looks like a Russian hat, doesn't it?
It is that, huh?
Right, so sometimes, though, you put them in your skep and then you put them in your hive.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still in a bite because I've heard folk just about in tears saying they've lost it again.
Sometimes, for I don't know the reason, but you'll put them in and it'll just come straight out, it'll come out next day.
They just make up their mind.
Aye. The majority of them, if you run them in at the right time into the hive, at the right time of day, etc., they will stay. But there is some, it's very difficult.
And you've got to find the queen with them as well. Make sure you've got the queen.
Are they?
And can the smell, is it something to do with scent as well?
Oh, scent is a lot to do with it. Oh, definitely. They definitely get the scent. And they, if you take a queen off that bush up here and take it over here and put it down the bees lock, move it to here because they smell it. Yeah.
And that distance?
Yeah. Oh, aye.
You do that think about bees smelling things, do you? Or bees' noses?
No, they certainly get the scent, aye, they do. Yeah, no question about it. And I think, it's never been proven, but I think they get to know people and all, because I can go about among bees and in my apiary,
mm-hmm.
and then I bother them, but if somebody strange comes with me, there's a good chance that they might be approached and stung.
No, you're telling me. I'm sitting here quite content so far. Now you tell me this. Look, there's a nithering up there. It's got a lot of activity up there by your door.
No, that in there is, that's not a swarm. That's a stalk there. It's been there for a year or two. It's very strong and I do expect it to swarm.
Can you tell from the got to swarm?
I have a fair idea by how they're activating, yes.
Last question.
Uh-huh.
Can we learn something for bees?
Oh, aye, my God. If we, that's really a goodie nut. If
bees.
We really have a lot to learn for the bees. Because they keep the offing so clean. They all work so hard and they all have their own job. And there's no wasted time. There's no arguments because the queen is in complete control. It would be a better world to live in.
And I echo that sentiment. Master beekeeper Ian Smith, dinner can fit comes first, the bees or the wisdom, maybe at the same time. But even the delivery man, the van driver, was rushed off his wheels this last few weeks, delivering stuff for the swarms and for the bee group. Eric arrived in his van with 2 big boxes the other day and he said, Kenneth, Abdi's swarming. Mrs. Stevenson's doing the slack, she's swarming. Bill Eccles, he's swarming. And you're swarming out here. He said, nobody's swarming. See, you're not only even swarming. I've just said to Steve Byrne, you see that bit about the bees with the scent, they can smell. I said, bees have noses and you can hear them sneezing. And he says, can you?
Well, I'll tell you this. Their sense of smell is something incredible, because I was reading, we didn't often feature sport in this programme, apart from your former exploits in your athletic days.
Uh-huh.
But... there was a football match done in England between Oldham and Blackburn to get a beekeeper in, because a queen bee had located herself on one of the goalposts. So they had to postpone the game. So there was all these things on Twitter about how you couldn't be serious. It was unbelievable. And now the bee team's off the pitch and all this kind of stuff.
Great stuff, Steve. Now, we've crossed the great divide and we've gone into vigils. And you can see... and here, Ian speaking with me about bees on our first videos, and you can find that video on our website, www.scotsradio.com, www.scotsradio.com, and going into the bitty, the box, it says Extra Bitties. I thought it was a great, I couldn't think of another title, Extra Bitties and Videos. Okay, so Extra Bitties and Videos, click on that box and you'll find that video with Ian speaking about his bees, and you can actually see I've risked life and limb, you can bring in these things to you.
Aye.
I was out there amongst the bees and the swarm, but that's an amazing big bar of bees.
Aye.
You can see them picking them off of trees. Right, before we go, Mine on that soon, I'll let you hear at the start of the programme. Any ideas for that, Liz?
Some kind of ornithological something or other.
Oh, that's really quite exacting. You'll make a journalist.
Oh, I didn't kind of keep a Capper Keely or something.
Okay, right. Fit is a duke squawking, some folks said. Pheasants muttering. Fitz marking the piping soon. Well, according to Ian, that's a rare soon, a rare soon. That's a bee. That's the new queen, just hatched, telling her new followers to be that she's just about to flee off and they have to follow her. The quacking noise, okay, this is the bees just about to swarm. Mm. The quacking noise is the new queen's still in their cell, just going demented, and they hatched, getting demented, as I said, about fits about to happen. They say, you can't do that, you can't. So they're quacking, being demented, and she's going, beep, beep,
Genzo.
Isn't that an amazing sound for a
never
bee?
Never heard the like, Genzo.
Can we hear it again, Richie? Just give us a quick blast of the piping bee, just so you can remember us. A bee, and then the birds, bee, the piping noise, and that's the demented.
That's like a sea lion.
Isn't that amazing? You've heard it first here. Music befitting chasing swarms. Myra and Anna, for their Dublin album. This is the Hornpipes. With the hornpipes. And if I get permission for the Tarlin Bee Group, I'm going to put up some photographs of them catching the swarms up my trees, up their ladders, all dressed up in their bee costumes. Well, not bee costumes, they're not dressed as bees. Like. But I was thinking again in that when a wee story that Jess told me, she was speaking to Ian Shields and myself about the Killiecrankie thing again, and it is related to bees, believe it or not. And she said, you see, the woad that the warriors, the Scotsmen, wore wasn't it like the blue woad that he saw in the Mel Gibson Phil. Hmm. You see, Braveheart. You know, they had the blue paint. He said, Jess says, it was resin they put in their bodies. Yeah. Sticky resin. Aye. So it kept them warm. And they took off their clothes, you see, for they come doing the health, and they were charging. And to reveal that their whole bodies were covered in resin. And since you're telling my story, as I could think, it was all these... Yeah, I was thinking, but I thinking about it, all these bodies fleeing in through the battlefield, and there's all these midges, and there's all these bees, and there's a sticky resin, and there's a bodies with sticky resin. I can imagine.
Just like the front of a car.
I just think like flea paper. You know, and all these bees sticking. I wish we're going on a bit. Anyway, it's time to think about other things. Trail and a boot. Other bits of festival, Steve?
Well, when I leave here the day, I'm going home to practice because I'll be playing with Fred Morrison at a thing called Piping Live, which is taking place in Glasgow. That's the Glasgow International Piping Festival, 10th to the 16th of August. And there's a World Pipe Band Championships and all sorts of concerts going on. Mullican Tar Music Festival, the 19th to the 23rd of August in Campbelltown. Festival not that far for us here in Edinburgh is Inner Leithen, a lovely festival, 21st to 23rd of August, and a hill host of guests headlined by Eddie Reader. And at the start of September, I'll be making my way back up to Angus for the Kerrymuir Festival.
That's a good one.
Kerry, the 4th to the 6th, and I'll be one of the guests there, so blowing my own trumpet again. But plenty going on, of course, being the high festival season in Scotland.
Get you out of the house. Get you out of the house. And speaking about playing with Fred Morrison, you were playing with Freda Morrison just the other day. Because before we go, can we just say a big thank you to the organisers of the Kirstorfin Folk for hosting Fit. Was just one of the most enjoyable nights I've had for a long time at... What's the name of the house again, Steve?
It's called the Dower House in Kirstorfin. It's run by the Kirstorfin Trust.
It's a great house. I think it is the oldest still lived in building house in Edinburgh.
I think it said aye. You know, between that and John Knox's house, it's the oldest habitable house in Edinburgh.
Habitable, that's the word, aye. And can we say, we're now joined by my niece who was with us last night at the concert, Delaine Morrison.
Hello.
And the write-up for Kenneth, thank you for that lovely write-up, Kenneth, as well. And he said, it's not often you get an auto harp being played in the same concert as a Jew's harp, because Stevie were playing the Jew's harp, mm-hmm. Beautiful. And folks saying, fits an auto harp. So you've seen your auto harp. Use a wee blast in your auto harp.
This is it here. Okay. That was the bum note was intentional.
So the background to the auto harp, how many strings has it got for me?
I think it's 32.
Aye. Well, but just believe
too many for me to count.
Too many. Origins, we think, for Germany?
Originally for Germany, although there's arguments about the patent.
Aye. But you see a lot of folk in the Appalachian Mountains play the auto harp. We went to see Peggy Seeger. My niece teamed me to see Peggy Seeger. And fit a cracking concert that was as well. Of course, Peggy Seeger plays the auto harp, so does our loons.
Aye.
That was pretty good as well. But as I said, we have to say a big thank you to the organisers or the Kirstorfin folk, because it was a very special evening.
It's lovely. It's a great run of concerts in Edinburgh. It's a relatively new thing in the last mm-hmm. few years, and all sorts of acts. They had the Tannehill Weavers in there with the pipes and everything. And it's not a big room.
It's not a big room, and they're hearing Emily Smith quite soon. So it's, you know, look out for the concerts, but you kind of get in because their eyes sell too before they just up. Well, that's it for the new, and I just have to say thanks to our soon sorter, Richie Werner, because we're back in Moraine Hoose again.
That's right.
Back in Moraine. We're in the studio.
The nest.
We were in tablecloth.
The hive. We're back in the hive.
Back in the back to bees again. So thank you to Richie, of course. So on behalf of Steve and Richie and our special guest, Delaine, we'll leave you with one of my favourite songs and versions, not just because he's here, not because he's a chum, sung by our very own Steve Byrne through the Malinky album, Far Better Days. This is The Wild Geese. For me, Freda Morrison, by the new.
Tell me if it was on your road, you're roaring Norland wind, as you've come ploughing frae the land that's never frae my mind. My feet they travel England, but I'm dying for the north. My mama saw the sellout tides run up the Firth of Forth. And when they kent them wheel and yoke, and finally fall and drive, fain I'd feel the creeping mists on yonder shore that lies. For saw ye as ye pass them by, for saw ye on the way, my mama rocked the roving gulls that sail up in the Tay. But saw ye neath in the yon wind afore ye come to Fife, for there's muckle lying yonder Tay means mair to me nor life. My man has swept the Angus braes ye hanna trod for years. Oh, went for gie a aimless loon that canna see for tears. Straths, I saw the wild geese flee. A lang, lang skein o' beaten wings, their heats towards the sea. And aye their crying voices trailed, I hent them on the air. Oh, when te mercy had ye wished, for I did not listen there. And far above the Angus Straths I saw the wild geese flee. A lang, lang skein o' beaten wings that heats towards the sea. And I their crying voices trail, I hent them on the air. Oh, when te mercy had ye wished, for I darna listen.